It's The Wonky Show. Financial sustainability is back in the news, so we're assessing where we are as a sector, and it's not all good news. We're asking how and why you should map cold spots of higher education around the country, and discussing why student housing is back on the agenda. It's all coming up.
What I find particularly interesting is whenever we ask the public about what they think about higher education, they say, we don't care. It is much lower down than lots of other things.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to fill the cold spots in the higher education policy discussion this week, as usual, we have three fantastic guests. In London, it's Gavin Conlon, partner at London Economics. Gavin, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I'm going to say, for those people who are listening to this after Sunday and haven't listened to this for a couple of days, it's Arsenal beating Nottingham Forest on Saturday.
Bold. And in Cambridge, it's Sally Burdenshaw, Director in the Education Practice at Public First. Sally, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, everyone. My highlight of the week is convincing my 11-month-old daughter that she wants to walk on her own rather than holding both hands, which is terrible for everybody's back and posture. Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, you're telling me. And in Liverpool, it's Jim Coe, Wonky's associate editor, and more importantly, head of the practice in Scotland for counterculture. Jim, your highlight of the week, please.
Thanks, Mark. My wife and I have just come back from a wonderful breakfast on a Thursday morning, which we do every week, trying to fit in between work and busy childcare. So that is my highlight of the week.
Beautiful. So we'll start the week with financial sustainability. Talk us through it, Jim.
Thanks, Mark. So it won't escape regular listeners to the show that financial sustainability has been leading the news week in, week out, right across the sector. The Office for Students has a new report out that suggests almost 200 higher education providers in England will be in deficit during the 25-26 academic year, and over 100 are projected to have less than 30 days net liquidity. Two caveats to the information. These are lag indicators. The information for the current financial state of the sector will not be available until approximately December 2025. So secondly, it does not include all the savings that the sector is seeking to make. Nonetheless, the Office for Students is saying this will require the kind of transformational action to reshape institutions for the future. A difficult situation that it is unlikely tuition fees alone will ameliorate.
Right, so this has been a running theme on The Wonky Show, on wonky.com, national press now for quite a long time. This isn't news to listeners that the sector has issues with financial sustainability, but it's getting worse rather than better, right, Sally?
Yeah, I think one of the things that was really striking to me was you hear the numbers and then you look at the percentages. The figures that Jim just talked about, is 72% of HE providers could be in deficit by 25-26, and 40% have fewer than 30 days liquidity, which I think just gives us a sense of the sort of the scale, and both in numbers but also across the sector. And this sort of feels like it in part is constantly surprising the sector, who are consistently very optimistic. So in the last forecast from the Office for Students, there was a suggestion that this might be the case, and that possibly the sort of we'll recruit our way out of any of these challenges was perhaps not going to live up to our expectations, and indeed that seems to be true. I think there's sort of a fear for me, firstly, in asking the sector to sort of mark its own homework in that sense, and also the massive lag time on this that Jim has just sort of highlighted, that it feels like we are constantly behind and off the pace on this, which makes it really difficult. If we don't have the figures, we can't be having the conversations about what's happening now, which when it comes to financial sustainability and the fact we only have 30 days liquidity in 40% of our institutions, feels like we need 30-day forecasts, not lag data by a year.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Kevin, how serious question, how worried should we be about 30-day liquidity of a university?
I mean, I think there's lots of issues with this report. I mean, 30 days liquidity is really problematic, and it basically sort of suggests that, you know, 40% of institutions don't have enough money in the bank to pay salaries at the end of the month. I mean, that's how serious it is. I mean, as a private sector organization, if I had, in the company I work in, if there was less than 60 days liquidity, I mean, I wouldn't be sleeping at night. I would be absolutely in a panic. Yeah. And, you know, I would be out chasing every invoice. And I would be also delaying payment from my suppliers. I'd be sort of stretching, you know, to basically hold on to cash. I mean, there are a couple of other things in this report. I mean, you know, the OFS says that income in the sector in 25-26 will be about 7-8% less than in 22-23. So you think over 3-4 years, the sector has declined by almost a tenth. But the other thing that was really interesting about this was, you know, you talk about opportunity for growth. I mean, in terms of their forecast for international students, international postgrads, no growth until 25, 26. Postgrads, UK postgrads, no growth in 24, 25, 25, 26. Undergraduate home students, it only grew by 1.3% in 24, 25. And the variation across the sector is the really troubling thing I see. You know, it's going to be a more stratified system because large research institutions, they predicted the numbers of UCAS applicants would go up 1%. They went up 10%. But for large teaching institutions, they predicted a 5% increase, only went up 1%. And for medium-sized institutions, they predicted a 5% increase, and they went down 5%. International students, down 16% in 24-25, where the forecast was plus 6%. And then particular countries, India down 20%, Nigeria down 45%. So it's, I mean, all of this, I mean, there's no, you know, positive notes here at all. And the thing that really worries me about this is people might say, you know, more generally, well, you know, inflation is now 2.3%. It jumped from 1.7 to 2.3%. So things are sort of, you know, okay and stabilizing. I mean, people forget that the price level is still 20-25% higher than it was 3 years ago. 40-50% of institutional income is fixed, essentially. I mean, forget about the tuition fee rise. That's just obliterated by the national insurance contributions. But if the price level is 20% higher and inflation is still 2.3%, it's basically saying that there's been a sort of a massive gash to an artery. But it's not, the bleeding isn't getting any worse, but it's still spurting out at the same rate. So the sector is in, I mean, it's really, really problematic, I think, and how widespread it is. We might come to this later, but in Scotland, you know, it's probably even worse because of the nature of the funding and the level of institutional income received from central government, essentially.
Yes, I was going to ask you, Jim, because I know Scotland and the University of Scotland. You do a lot of work there, don't you? They're calling for Scottish Government to help out with this, with the national insurance rise this week, and kind of making quite a lot of noise about it north of the border, and probably rightly so. But they're facing a even more of a perfect storm, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Institute for Fiscal Studies put it better than I could, have said it's a case of rising costs, diminishing government funding, and falling international student recruitment. I mean, it's the absolute, as you said, Mark, the perfect storm. I suppose there's two fundamental issues here, though, where Sally rightly points out that the plan for many institutions has been to say, okay, we can grow our way out of this. But the fundamental issue is that there's sort of, there's no choice. The way that the higher education funding system works is your absolute main source of income is student recruitment, and your absolute main source of income within that is international student recruitment. At the point you are unable to grow either of those, then you get into trouble and it becomes contagious within the sector. I think the second big challenge that everybody is sort of hitting on here, the fact that the sector has got into a difficult financial position is not surprising. And the Office for Students has been putting out briefing notes for what, the last 2 or 3 years, using words to the effect of the sector is in a difficult financial position. The sector must transform. The sector has to do X, Y, and Z. And then for that period to not have got live data or better data collection or even adopted some of the practices of COVID, of that sort of enhanced work, seems utterly bizarre to me. I don't know why it's not been done. I can't really get my head around it, to be honest, Mark.
Jim, it's really interesting because we've done some work recently on exactly this. And what seems really striking was that it was a conversation that we were driving in the sector, and the sector were sort of, you know, keen to have in that everybody, it's everybody's greatest fear, but the structures around what does happen if we have, an institution that fails, just seem to be so far removed from the reality of how close we are to that happening. And I think that to me is really terrifying. And there is, you know, there is no playbook for how we manage institutional failure, either at scale, so, you know, a significant institution in terms of their size, or multiple small institutions. And yet, because that's not how the system was designed, that's not how it was ever conceived of. We had a market, but we did not expect for institutions to fail or go bust or however you want to talk about it. But that is the reality now. And it feels like for every individual institution, it's not that I place blame at their door for being as optimistic as they possibly can. Because like you say, Jim, there is no other option to say we'll recruit out of this. But at a sector level, and for the regulator, we simply must have better systems in place than we currently do. And hopefully the work that we've been doing in this space sort of starts that conversation, but what hasn't currently translated to is into sure regulatory sort of action structures.
No, I couldn't agree more, Sally. And it feels, you know, I think from an institutional level, the idea of going bust is almost too horrible to imagine. But particularly public institutions, we should remember there are some private institutions who have gone bust. But, you know, I've always likened it to Theseus and the Minotaur. You sort of stick the Minotaur in the labyrinth and hope something comes along long and kills it eventually. And, you know, that's not always a given. I think one of the things that concerned me slightly in the Office of Students report was towards the end saying, you know, we encourage sector dialogue, we hope people come forward early. I don't think there is that level of, trust is probably too strong, but there's not that level of conversation between the sector and the regulator, where I think there's going to be lots of people who come forward and put their hands up and say, hey, Office of Students, as our main regulator, we're in trouble. Can you come help us out? Like, it doesn't quite seem to be the feeling across the sector for me somehow.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, this thing about coming forward, I mean, remember back in the days of COVID, like there was like an email address that you could write to at the Department of Education, you know, if you were essentially sort of facing financial difficulties for as an institution. And the basic email address was we'reindeeptrouble.education.gov.uk. And it wasn't exactly sort of encouraging people to sort of come forward. The other thing is, like, you look at the thing about the student numbers. Everybody is, all institutions are wildly optimistic about, you know, how they're going to do. Everybody, I mean, except the large research institutions, but, you know, all the large teaching and medium-sized teaching institutions, creative arts, et cetera, and the small specialists, they all predicted 5-10% increase in numbers, and they were all either, you know, zero or down 20%, whatever it is. So it's really problematic. I think the other thing here is just that, you know, people sort of historically have pointed the finger and sort of said, well, you know, it's these four or five institutions that are sort of deeply problematic and, you know, can't sort of organize their finances. What we're talking about here, though, is, you know, it's all institutions, even if they're well run. Every institution is facing problems. And, you know, you might sort of say, well, there are some institutions that are just too big to fail and they're, you know, prestigious and they've been around for hundreds of years. These institutions are financially in deep trouble as well. It's not just the new kids on the block. It's everyone. And, you know, the problem is going to be is that you sort of see now people just shut down chemistry departments or physics departments or whatever it might be. It's, you know, amputations taking place as opposed to salami slicing and just getting rid of the marginal employee. It's just taking an absolute sort of, you know, butcher's knife to it.
Sally, yeah, I want to look ahead a bit. So, I mean, we diagnose the problem and things are very bad. Your infinitely wise boss wrote on the pages of wonky.com a couple of weeks ago about...
No, don't call him that. We try and reduce his ego.
I was thinking of Rachel, actually.
Excellent. You know,
who, you know, I'm under contract to say, you know, but she is always very astute about how universities are perceived by politicians of all different stripes. And you know, her argument is that essentially, you know, universities are, as we know, you know, not very high up on the list of investment. That said, you know, the early move to decide not to cut further, you know, as Gavin said, you know, not slashing the artery open even more, is something. But that's a kind of holding pattern, isn't it? It takes us, you know, gets us through to the next couple of years where, you know, obviously the sector's got to have to manage through that. But is there any hope? Is there any hope that something could change or turn around in terms of that national conversation about investing in universities? And could, you know, is there any chance that, you know, the government could decide to go further than deciding not to cut further, you know, if you see it that way?
Yeah, I mean, Debbie wrote a really interesting article the other day where she talked about whether you have an optimistic or pessimistic take on HE. I always want to be optimistic. And there is lots of cause for optimism, even at this point, I think. What I find particularly interesting is whenever we ask the public about what they think about higher education, they say, we don't care. It is much lower down than lots of other things. Until you ask about sort of very particular things. And so when we ask about whether the public care about a university going bust, and particularly their local university going bust, they are really worried about that. So for me, that is really important because this is not in many areas. And I think we take the sort of plethora of London institutions slightly out of this. But even then, obviously there are hyperlocal institutions with sort of influence on their communities. But particularly sort of as you leave London, a university in a region cannot go bust without having a significant impact on its local economy. And Labour are very alive to this. That is both a fantastic opportunity for institutions to be anchors and to get behind the government's agenda for growth, to, you know, strengthen and invest
invest in local communities. But also, as it comes to it, you know, university failure at the moment, the regulator has historically taken a really hard line on this, you know, sort of saying universities fail, they fail. Just don't feel like that's where Labour are at, and also what the right thing for most of those institutions would be and the people they serve.
Yeah, yeah. But the other good news in there is, based on Public First polling, is that, you know, time and time again, it's, you know, shown that, that people found putting more money into universities unpopular, even including index linking fees. And this was shown as an example of why, you know, no government is ever going to do this, because it was so deeply unpopular. But they did do that just 2 weeks ago, and there was a pretty minor backlash in pretty predictable places, and everyone moved on, didn't they? So the fact that the government was happy to look at that research and go, yep, no, people, you know, there's going to be lots of people very unhappy with that, but we have to do that anyway, that surely bodes well for future such decisions.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm about to undermine the whole sort of entity of my organisation, but Public First asks the public first, but we don't always agree with the public, and it doesn't mean that experts should agree. It's about knowing what the public think, right? And sometimes that's very important. And sometimes it is also part of the wider picture about taking very difficult decisions. And I have been really pleased that this government has seemed much more interested in taking difficult decisions in tandem with the sector and thinking about that big picture. At the moment, that is still relatively short term. I don't think anybody feels like we are on a sort of long term positive footing. But it is a good positive first step.
Yeah. Listen, I'm going to counterbalance that. I mean, I appreciate the optimism. I've never experienced it myself, but you know, I'll listen. I'm a professional economist. I'll do the pessimistic route. I mean, listen, it is great. The fact that you know, with Labour, I mean, there's adults in the room. Okay, I mean, that's the most important thing. So the point about local institutions, you know, they're not going to go under, they're not going to be allowed to fail, and they're not going to close the doors, and the Labour government will make sure that doesn't happen. I'm absolutely sure of. They know that would cause local and regional devastation if you lose, you know, an employer with 4,000 or 5,000 employees, you know, and a local or a region would not recover from the loss of a university. So that is great. The issue, though, is like, you know, that's a pretty pessimistic, I mean, that's the lowest common denominator, essentially. I mean, the real issue is more generally is that, you know, you look at the wider economy. I mean, we need economic growth. That's it. I mean, that's what everything is tied to. And if we don't have economic growth, then there's, you know, there's insufficient taxation receipts, and therefore there's going to be insufficient funding for universities and schools and hospitals and everything else. And this is the problem that, like, you know, the UK economy has been, you know, woeful for 14 years. And, you know, the Labour government is coming in. Okay, so there hasn't been any sort of economic growth since they came in, as you would expect. But, you know, they're facing a sort of an almost insurmountable problem because the economy is just habitually underperforming. And as long as the sort of wider economy is like that, there is just literally no room for manoeuvre in terms of what resources might be made available to institutions. I think, you know, this is like a holding pattern until we see an uptick in economic growth. Now, where that economic growth is going to come from, it's difficult to say. It really is difficult to say.
Yeah. And, you know, not to be the sort of, I'm going to defy the stereotypes of being the professional norther on the panel and being sort of glum about the whole thing. I think there's a couple of things that stand out to me. So we find ourselves in an unusual place to make the argument that universities should be saved based on their levels of employment, not on their sort of nature of their academic outstanding qualities. And I think it is a really, really difficult conversation to have of should a provider be saved regardless of their financial sustainability because of their importance to players, not because of the impact of the provider itself. And I think that is an unusual place for us. However, I think the sort of bigger risk is that not that there is an instant collapse, but as you described, Gavin, you lose bits of departments here, you put research funding elsewhere, you think things can be done efficiently in other places, and, you know, eventually you move on and on forever until we have this thing called a university sector, but it is smaller, not doing what it once was, and actually it is then perennially harder to defend its value because its proposition is just weakened over time.
Oh, just a final thought that the amount of airtime, I think, Jim, you're absolutely right, that this is taking up, and the incredibly low benchmark that is, can we keep individual institutions solvent, detracts from a much wider conversation that I think is a huge shame. And that is where we are. And it's not to say that I'm not optimistic about what could happen in the future, but I do think that that means that the opportunity cost of talking about the way in which we teach, the way in which we research, and what we can be doing to serve our communities is lost in this at the moment. And that's something that I think we should all work.
Good note to end on that. But okay, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Laurie Phipps. I'm the Senior Research Lead at JISC. I'm Visiting Professor of Digital Leadership at the University of Chester. Together with Dr. Donald Anklow, Senior Research Fellow at Munster Technological University, and Professor Richard Watermeyer, Centre for Higher Education Transformations, University of Bristol, we wrote, Do We Need a League Table of Scholars? Have you ever been told you're in the top 0.05% of something? It'd feel good, right? But what if that recognition came from a system you've never heard of, ranking your value with metrics scraped from the internet? Our colleague Richard was one of a number of academics that received an unsolicited certificate from a company he had never heard of. At first, he thought it was spam, and he reached out to me and Donna, and we started talking about it. In the article, we try and unpack what impact these sorts of companies and platforms might have on the academy. For example, is it meritocratic, or does it just amplify existing inequalities, favouring certain scholars at elite institutions while marginalising a large and diverse group of others? We try and talk about these questions in the article and a variety of others. Thanks.
Now, there's been an interesting new report about university cold spots. Sally, walk us through it.
Yeah, Mark. So actually, interestingly for the sector, this isn't a report. This is a series of maps. The British Academy Shape Observatory has published these maps, and they show regional and local cold spots. They use the HESA returns year on year, and you can look at year on year from 2011-12. And the idea is that you can see which subjects are being underserved by university provision in arts, humanities, and social sciences, shaped to match STEM. And it includes a breakdown also by tariff. So we can see where students with lower academic attainment are able to stay in their locality if they want to pursue a certain subject at university, which I thought very interestingly was described on Wonky Estate as a potential freezing out of students in their locality in different parts of the country if it's not available. So you can go down a rabbit hole of clicking lots of different buttons to make the maps do lots of different things for you as per normal. You can compare the subjects, the years, the differences between institutions. So for some examples, you can see that geographical coverage of French has significantly receded since 2011. You can see that subjects were already very limited in 2011, such as Celtic studies have become more so. And you can see that there are massive cold spots for some subjects, like, for example, anthropology. There's also some good news. So you can see the market working, that subject areas like finance, law, sociology have increased their coverage. So that sort of probably speaks to the wider expansion of HE and also one that has sort of responded to student demand. But when you filter out high tariff institutions, you can see that there are also some subjects that are incredibly inaccessible, particularly things like theology and religious studies, which have become much less accessible over the course of the last sort of 10, 15 years. London is served incredibly well. There's always dark blue concentrated on the map. So that the sort of heat map at its highest for basically all the subjects. You can go down this rabbit hole and you can make lots of different comparisons. But I think that the key thing for me was that when you think about this in terms of student choice and also who can choose, this suddenly becomes actually much more than a series of sort of pretty maps. We know that the young people who are less able to travel, or the people, but particularly sort of the young people, if we're thinking about the students making decisions at 18, are those disadvantaged young people. They are the people who are most likely to stay in their region, and though they will be restricted in terms of what they can choose, that's a terrible shame for them, and also for what is happening in those particular regions. And sort of the complete lack of particular skills and knowledge in a particular region. It does have some limitations, which the authors are absolutely pains to highlight. So these are the first iteration. So they're not overclaiming about what this can do. There are going to be multiple iterations in the future. So it's only as good as the data, which is just an evergreen statement. It doesn't show nuance about multiple campuses, for example. And they also use 60 kilometers as the commutable distance for where they are saying young people or people can commute to. But that is not true across kind of every locality. So transport of across 60 kilometres, which includes, you know, a really good transport network in the southeast, might be very different to trying to cross Scotland. So it's really interesting. Lots of food for thought, and I'm excited to see what happens next. And I think what this does add is sort of a focus and richness to some of the discussions about shape subjects, which is always a welcome insight when we are often so focused on STEM.
So this also follows on, doesn't it, Jim, quite well from our earlier conversation, because if you're looking at this from a government point of view, this is as an interesting tool, obviously with some limitations, and doesn't cover, you know, every single type of subject and everything that happens at universities. But it does point to an interesting way of thinking about how we could plan or at least incentivize a system of delivering higher education and perhaps, you know, broader tertiary tertiary education on a kind of regional skills basis. We've been talking about this for decades, but there's something in there right now, though, isn't there?
Yes, there's a lot in that, Mark. But you know, as an arts graduate, I end up feeling instinctively defensive of saying actually everyone should have access to art no matter where they are. You know, feeling sort of moved by Shakespeare, or you know, being able to go and see great art and understand this and sort of interpreting and coming to the world with a new point of view, I think is inherently valuable. However, I think one of the things that is always missing from this debate is having a broad-based curriculum which includes a large amount of arts and social sciences programs, SHAPES programs, whatever you want to call them, is a good insurance against an unpredictable labour market and allows people to develop a broad range of skills. There was a report out in 2020 by this organisation called London Economics, I don't know if you've heard of them, Gavin, called Qualified for the Future, Quantifying Demand for Arts, Humanities and Social Science Skills. And I come back to it time and time again, thinking about what is SHAPE doing for our sector. And one of the things that always stuck with me is that of the 10 fastest growing sectors in the UK, 8 employ more graduates from the arts, humanities and social sciences than other disciplines. Having a approach to skills and employment and what does the future of our labour market look like is answering the same question of how do we get people to develop broad-based skills that can meet the needs of the future, of which SHAPE is clearly part of it.
Yeah. So listen, there's two things. I mean, listen, thanks for the plug, Jim. That's really appreciated. You know, I'll be doing a signing of books like at Waterstones next Tuesday.
That'd be great. Nah,
yeah, no problem. So listen, there's a couple of interesting things about this. I mean, the first thing is, if you look at the change in, you know, location of SHAPE students, I mean, some of this is driven by what's been happening in the secondary schools. So essentially, the removal of the requirement to undertake a modern foreign language, you see essentially the change in the number of students undertaking French or German or Scandinavian studies or whatever, you know, is declining. So you see French, for instance, declining across the piece. It goes from dark blue in 2011 to light blue across the country. That's really, really interesting in itself. So essentially, I'm sort of saying it's like there are external factors at play, and decisions that are made 10 years ago are coming home to roost now. The other interesting thing is, you know, if you look at supply and demand, so what are students aiming to do or seeking to undertake? So they're undertaking more economics, more business studies, more management, more law. And listen, let's face it, that may not be a good thing. Okay, we don't need more economists and lawyers. But you can understand why this is happening. So in a period where, again, I'm going back to the fact that we have like anemic economic growth for 15 years, going to university is now, it's not a consumption decision, it's more an investment decision. Where are the payoffs post-graduation? However, it's not all subjects that this is the case. And this is sort of quite encouraging. If you look at the heat map in terms of philosophy, social policy, psychology, you know, that's becoming bluer generally across the country. So it's not as if it's the case that, you know, it's a substitution between, you know, folks that would have studied psychology are now studying economics. You know, that's sort of moving in tandem a little bit. So there are sort of like plenty of positives about this. But the point is that, you know, if you did the exact same piece of analysis in relation to STEM, I mean, how different would it be? I mean, I think it would be sort of quite similar, you know, that there is like, you know, it's urban focused, that there are hot and cold spots. We know where those hot and cold spots are. So it's a useful tool, but, you know, I don't know how much it, you know, tells us just about like, you know, more general demographics.
It's one of the big challenges here that not how the entire thing lines up. So, you know, if I look at the decline of French as an example, that emerges precisely because of the changes in the curriculum at school level in French. So you simply don't have the supply of people who are going to French. Whereas when you get to business, you can enter it with a much broader range of qualifications. So there seems to me to be a bit of a mismatch here between actually here's the skills we want and here's how we encourage it from the age of 11 onwards. And then you get to university age and you're like, oh, hey, 18-year-olds, can you fix all the ills in the economy which we've designed for the past 18 years of your life?
Absolutely. I mean, but it just shows, I mean, there's a lack, I mean, but there is an issue about, you know, trying to provide or, you know, encouraging providers to provide additional, you know, courses in particular subjects and encourage SHAPE as opposed to like focusing on STEM. I think that's like sort of perfectly reasonable thing to sort of aspire to. But the issue is that, you know, that's just looking at the supply side. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago, you've got to look at both the supply and demand side in equilibrium. So I remember a couple of years ago, you know, the government was talking about getting rid of the NHS bursary. Okay. And they basically said, and it basically was a sort of an olive branch to the sector. They said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to, you know, increase supply by 10,000 places a year. And that basically bought off the sector. But that's just affecting the supply side. what happened was, if you raise the price of undertaking a nursing qualification by 70 or 80% by getting rid of NHS bursaries, essentially demand fell through the floor. And of course, those 10,000 additional places weren't filled, and even the existing places weren't filled. So I think trying to plan things on the supply side is well and good, but I think there has to be some, you know, you've got to look at trying to focus on the supply side is well and good, but you've got to focus on the demand side at the same time. And I think some of these issues that Sally talked about initially about, you know, this 60K commuting distance, 60K, I mean, in certain parts of the country, I mean, that is mental.
Oh, in Liverpool. I mean, it takes me an hour to get to Manchester. Never mind, sure, I go 60K from here. I mean, yeah, go on, sorry.
But it's a whole interconnectedness of the sector. I mean, you talk about, so how does HS2 or the cancellation of HS2 or not having an east-west line, et cetera, how does all this stack up? And what's the effect of these other wider government policies on, you know, the provision of SHAPE or STEM graduates going forward? Sorry, Sally.
Yeah, a couple of things. It was really interesting hearing you talk about sort of commuting then, because Emma Maslin has written on Wonky and done lots of research on sort of the experiences of commuter students and how they sort of are perceived in institutions. And one of the things that she talks about quite a lot is so that we don't acknowledge commuter students and the sort of the makeup of them and how many people now are commuting. And that's sort of, you know, mature students, increasingly the sort of 18-year-old demographic. I think to me, the explicit acknowledgement that they're of what a commute was there was helpful, even if there is not a unified agreement of what a commuter is and what that might mean. But absolutely, a massive difference in commuting 60 kilometres in some places than others.
And I suppose, Sally, I think what the interesting difference there is, a regional education policy which is built to meet regional needs. So you could say, actually, mm-hmm. one of the arguments you could say is there's a need for less specialisation and providers to work across bigger geographies. But actually, one of the main barriers to that is you have to have specialisation because it's so bloody hard to get anywhere.
Yeah,
and that's
absolutely.
Like an accidental policy design that you wouldn't choose to have, I don't think.
Yes, you could make a much stronger argument for regional concentration if you could actually get across your region. But the other thing that I thought this sort of linked to was our previous discussion on financial sustainability, which is, if we are saying that, you know, market forces shape institutions and we, you know, even if we're not having individual institutional failure, we are seeing quite significant reshaping of lots of institutions. But when we are thinking about which courses and why they are perhaps being closed, what implication does that have on a region is something that I think really is not spoken about enough. If you are the only institution delivering anthropology in the north of England, and then you decide that it's not financially viable, and so in order to keep your institution solvent, you close it down, where does that leave us? And I think that these two things actually tie in together really, really importantly in terms of what we think the sector looks like in the next 5 to 10 years. Do we have universities that are solvent, but they are actually all running a very narrow range of subjects? And what does that actually mean for those young people, mature learners, and whoever you want who wants to go and study anthropology, and they don't want to have to relocate to do it, and they don't want to have to travel for 4 hours to cross from Liverpool to Manchester because the trains aren't. I think they are all reasonable requests from individual students.
Now, every week this season, we'll be having a think about how things were and how things came to be. With City St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, here's a hidden history of higher education.
So the ending of the binary line in 1992 was more than just changing the names of polytechnics. The sector needed to come together, which meant equalising the funding of the different parties involved in that. There were two funding councils, PCFC and the USC, and they issued a set of joint circulars from a joint working party trying to work out the problems of how to bring the sector together. So one of those that they issued in April 1992 set out a series of challenges for this new sector. The two councils said, institutions need a sufficient degree of financial and academic stability to be able to plan and manage effectively. On the other hand, stability should not be achieved at the cost of ossification within the system. They wanted a dynamic sector. Government was very keen on the polytechnics, bringing the ability to expand quickly to the universities. And they proposed a core plus margin system so that the funding could slowly move together over time. They also have an issue that we'll come back to in future ones of these, where they talked about quality. They were quite keen that the funding methodology should promote quality. And so they proposed two methods, either that you should give more resource, either through increased numbers of funded places or through a funding premium, to those institutions assessed at providing high quality teaching and learning in particular subject categories. A question that still bedevils us. Or, and here's another one that looks forward to the current day, institutions with provision in particular academic subject categories assessed to be of unacceptable or verging on an unacceptable level of quality should be warned of a possible withdrawal of support, but given time before funding is withdrawn to bring the quality up to an acceptable level. So low-value courses, we were there trying to work out what they were in 1992. Government thought, or through its funding council, that these externally assessed high-quality ratings, a bit like a TEF, I suppose, irrespective of whether they attract additional places or funding, so like a TEF, are likely to be valuable guide to potential students and their advisors. The accolade should itself be a reward, unlikely to be a bit like the TEF then. Funding was stable, but did not keep pace with inflation. Schemes allowed fees-only recruitment, and it took the Deering and then the settlement after the BEP report to sort out the funding a bit. Although funding was to be fair across different types of institutions, the funding body could choose different premiums to favour certain HEIs. The removal of college fees from those places that had a collegiate structure, obviously aimed at two universities, resulted in an exciting historic building premium, money for buildings built before 1914, which seemed to favour two universities in particular. One of the challenges the new funding council was going to face was the need to constrain student numbers. Never one to resort to boom and bust, there had been a surge in student numbers in the early 90s. As an example, Leeds has added over 1,200 more students in 1991, before which contributed to an aggregate growth of 9.5%, quite a lot in a year. I looked up the exciting minute from the Senate of that, mostly as an example of lovely understatement. The minute says, the increase in home undergraduates is something greater, somewhat greater than the increase assumed in the recent Green Paper on student numbers. And the percentage increase in, increase in undergraduate student numbers was somewhat above the reported national average. Somewhat was doing quite a lot of work in that system. So Hefke had to come up with a solution. And what we got was the system of the maximum aggregate student number and then the additional student number system that came with it. This was a lovely system, and one that worked to control growth, allowing it across the sector, and was a great planning exercise every year. You had to stay within your target, which was built on what you had last year and any additional student numbers you got. 1% over the target would result in a penalty. Any shortfall would lead to a whole back of funding. You had to get your numbers exactly right each year. So you could slowly grow. And there's signs that some universities fluctuated around this mason. It didn't fix you in place forever. So universities could continue to grow through that period. What's interesting is actually some of those universities are rather smaller back then than they are now. So if you look at popular universities, say the University of York, in 1996, its Mazen, mostly linked to undergraduate students, was 4,262. University is much bigger than that now, and we continued to grow through this period. Interestingly, ministers, Vince Cable at the time, but Joe Johnson recently, called this a GOSS plan system. The idea was that it was centrally planned, but actually it wasn't. It was an aggregating system. Each institution could choose its own size and build over time. Additional student numbers became a great way for the government to incentivize people to do what it wanted. So you could get additional student numbers for following in particular ways. So you could get additional student numbers for being regional or doing sub-degree work or for having particular education provision. You could do subject areas that would push you in a certain subject area or for postgraduate work or even for graduate apprenticeships. So the subject system allowed things to move forward. Maximum aggregate number made every December very exciting for planning teams and registries, making sure that number was delivered exactly on the point, and generally the sector moved forward. Until, of course, we decided that we didn't need that anymore because we could move forward happily. Now, of course, we had our brief flirtation with student number capping and we moved away from it. Maybe we'll be back in the future. But it was part of the ability to move a sector forward without having big swings in student numbers. We'll see what happens when we come to fill in our HESI's return in December as to whether those big swings have happened again this year.
Now, student housing is back in the news. Gavin, tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so student housing. So I have been tasked to introduce this, and I was tasked to read an article in the Telegraph about student housing. So the interesting thing is, when I actually read it, I thought it was a remarkably left-wing article. I thought it was actually published by the Socialist Worker. It was so left-wing. Mind you, the Telegraph might not have realized it. But anyway, so what they were saying was student renters are pricing out families in university towns. So they basically went around and they've been talking with residents in Exeter, Durham and Leeds. and they run through the potential impacts of basically additional number of students in those localities. So they talk about higher prices, higher levels of crime, not committed by students, but committed on students, and lower levels of, you know, a sense of community and things like this. There's also discussion about antisocial behavior and some of the cheapest housing being sort of taken over by students. Okay, so there's various other pieces of work that have been going on in the area, and Jim Dickinson has written a blog about, you know, he's broken down the, you know, acquisition of housing for by student landlords in different council tax bands, and basically shown it's the cheapest housing that has been sort of taken over by students. Okay, so that was that. And the question is, well, why is it sort of remarkably left-wing? Because, you know, surprising from the Telegraph. So it really was a veiled criticism of government policy over the last 15 years. Basically, said, you know, what the Telegraph were really saying here was there's insufficient housing supply, number one, and I think we'd all agree with that. There's poor planning laws, and there's a level of NIMBYism that, you know, locals don't want new builds, you know, in their region. They also, the Telegraph alluded to the fact there's insufficient tax on property for investment. So I think that's something that needs to be addressed as well. And there needs to be additional powers and devolved powers to the regions so that they can actually overcome these planning issues. So I thought it was quite a critical article by the Socialist Worker Telegraph. And but I thought it was refreshing. I thought, like, you know, with the new government, I thought they were, you know, it was really sort of a pat on the back to some of the proposals that the new government is adopting. So who wants to come in on that?
Mark, is that a question, or are we just potting out the world's topsy-turvy? Right, hang on. Okay, right, let me do that again. Yeah, Gavin, so I think you're right, but I think there's a few things that are worth caveating what you've mentioned. Going back to the very, very first conversation we had about the fact that economic growth has been next to non-existent for the past 14 years, and there is a Labour government who are bent on, you know, improving planning services, increasing housing supply, I think it is inevitable there are going to be conflicts between different groups of people where they are competing over a limited range of affordable and accessible housing. Whether they are students, whether they are different communities, whether they are emerging communities, whatever, that is always going to be the case. I think one of the things that caught my eye in what Jim has been saying is that there's these ongoing references of students being sort of noisy neighbours, being unhelpful. Having been a student sabbatical, and a university staff member, I suppose I see it from a few perspectives. I think the thing where the Telegraph is perhaps not as left-wing as we may dream it could be, is the neglect to mention that, of course, students are more likely to be victims of crime than they are to be the people who are committing crimes, and the extent to which actually housing policy responds to the specific needs of students, in so much as they don't live in a place, usually, it's not always the case, for as long, their housing needs are different, they're often living in housing multiple properties, etc. So I suppose part of the answer to this is, how do we get better housing for everyone, and how do cities, particularly regions where they have the power to do so, use special planning powers to make better purpose-built student accommodation?
There's another question here I've got when I read this and what you said, Joe, maybe other people have a view on this. Do universities do enough to actually demonstrate the impact they have on the local economy? I mean, if you have 5,000-10,000 students knocking around, okay, you know, they do take up space in the buses and stuff like this. But I mean, you know, the cash injection into the local economy that everybody feels, I mean, it is felt, you know, maybe people only feel the loss of it once it's gone. But, you know, why is it the case that, like, you know, individuals, even though they value the local institution, as Sally was saying earlier, they don't equate that to, you know, the economic impact and potentially social impact that the positive economic and social impact that students are having. Why is there this dichotomy between?
I think so. You know, it's much harder to see, I think. So, like, when having, you know, met with how many residence groups across my life, the thing that really annoys them is noise, waste, bins being left out. The thing about actually, you know, so I used to live in Liverpool and Smith Down Road has had an enormous amount of regeneration of pubs and cafes and bars and things like that because of student spending. But that takes a decade. If my bins are overflowing, I'm annoyed about that in the afternoon. I think it's a time lag issue between the two things.
So does it always, as with everything, come down to the discount rate? People only see the stuff right in front of them, but don't see the stuff.
Or the people don't care. In that way, they want all the benefits without all the negatives. So we do lots of work where, for different institutions, where essentially we go and talk to local communities about what they think about their local institution, what they think about the students. Interestingly, when I looked at the recent work we have done for a number of different institutions, the availability of housing is consistently the thing that people report as the biggest negative impact of students. So I think this article chimes very much with what we are hearing with our sort of immersive research in different communities. Other things that they are particularly concerned about are things like
levels of travel, crime and antisocial behaviour, access to public transport. What they do think is a positive is the stuff that you were talking about just now, about the sort of the small businesses benefiting. So particularly things like takeaways and small shops, seems fair. We think about a sort of cliche student lifestyle. Cultural events and interestingly, education and training opportunities for local residents and volunteering charities and community events. So all of these things, like that, it's not, I think, that people aren't acknowledging always that there are benefits, but that they are intention and people would just like the benefits. And that's sort of a classic, you know, individual position, right? They want to see the benefits of students without those challenges. And I think that something that I think, James, you picked up on earlier was about the way in which universities communicate. And again, part of the reason we do this work with different institutions is to think about what is it that people care about and what should they be talking as a result. And often there's quite a big mismatch about what institutions think people care about. So people think they care about, international research, and they think they care about ref scores or whatever. And people don't understand that stuff, and they don't care. What they do want to know is how universities are educating and upskilling people to contribute to the NHS and the regional economy. And that is nearly always the findings that we get. And so I think that some of this is about universities being a bit more empowered to talk to people in their communities about what they care about. In order to offset some of these challenges, which do exist and we shouldn't ignore them. But I think in terms of kind of public opinion and engaging with communities, that is something that individual institutions could do.
I think on that trade-off point, Sally, you're entirely right. Yeah. And one of the reasons I believe that is because whenever I get a taxi early morning or sort of out, the taxi driver will always say to me, we really miss it when the students are gone. And because for them, the trade-off is we either have people or we don't. And they have that direct relationship with people in the city. I think there's another thing as well of, you know, we do a lot of work of trying for universities to express their GVA and what's their impact, and they create these many spin-outs and these many jobs. And exactly as you say, and I think this is where part of the levelling up civic university agenda came from, is do you actually make my place better? And better often means is, do my kids feel like things are better, are my streets cleaner, and is it a nicer place to live? And that sort of ephemeral, nice, like soft around the edges stuff, we're just not quite as good at articulating, I don't think.
Does anyone think, you know, all of this is a mask? You know, the complaints about students, I mean, we're talking about domestic students here, just let's say, that all of this is like a mask for just wider levels of pain and angst felt by, you know, the wider UK economy. I mean, there's always been people been banging on about international students, you know, and we did a piece of work, you know, a little plug, you know, benefit to cost ratio is 10-1 for international students. They bring infinitely more than they take out of the system. But the pain that, you know, the country as a whole is experiencing, is living through, and has lived through for the last 15 years, is this just a reflection of, you know, the fact that living standards have declined across the piece, that there is no housing, that the local authorities haven't built any housing, that there's no money, that the, you know, people can't get the benefits that they feel they have a justifiable, you know, they should justifiably receive, et cetera, et cetera. That everything in their whole lives has been sort of eroded year after year after year, where 15 years ago, they might think, you know, I can manage to go on holiday for a week or 2 weeks somewhere, that's like essentially an impossibility now. And all of this, everything, the wider macroeconomy is like, you know, basically people just are targeting with a laser focus and blaming, you know, whether it be domestic students, international students, whoever it might be. It's just, you know, the next target.
Kevin, when I read your article, the Telegraph article,
don't ever say that again.
The article that you so pithily summarized.
The social worker one. Can we just edit that, please? Okay, go on.
What really struck me was that if you read this and you replaced students with immigrants, I think you could write a very, very similar article. And so I just thought to speak to your point that I think that when you have a defined other group that people know who they are and they can vent their frustration on, that is a risk. And so maybe this is not specific to students, or I don't think it is specific to students. It is about a group of other people.
Yeah, it's wider angst. But it all comes back to, you know, everything is interlinked, and it comes back to economic growth, and it's about
says the Economist.
Yeah, but it's true. I mean, you know, if you look at the average household earnings at the moment, I mean, you know, they're basically flat from where they were in 2010-11. I mean, they should be about £12,000 per annum per household higher. People should be £1,000 a month more in their pockets now than they actually do. And a grand a month is a lot of cash. It's a huge amount of cash. I mean, you can't expect people to be happy. And, you know, we're seeing that. And people are just like, you know, in the gutter. I mean, that's the problem.
And I think, you know, just I suppose to wrap that bit up, is that it also does add to a sense of a changing place. And you're comfortable with that change if you are economically mobile, the idea of going off to study is sort of not an anathema to you. But if I've been living in the same place for 14 years and I've not seen my household income increase, I've seen things get harder, I cannot go on that holiday, as you mentioned, Gavin, and then I've got my entire place changing as well, and it feels like actually the stuff that's moving in is the things I'm not interested in, well, then that is hard. Like, not only am I sort of being washed away in the tides of globalization, economic decline, it is also reinforced on my doorstep by groups of people who I believe don't understand my life. I can imagine that isn't easy.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Sally, Gavin, Jim Kerr and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky. Whatever.